down at the bees coating her hand and said quietly, "The one with the red beard, little ones." Then she held her hand out, as if offering them a gift. It took a moment, but as each bee took flight, it unerringly sought out Redbeard. He flinched as first one and then another buzzed past him and then came back, circling.
"Call them back or we kill the child!"
he cried out suddenly. He battered at them ineffectually with the branch of candles he held. Molly instead stooped suddenly and heaved up the whole hive as high as she could.
"You'll kill her anyway!"
she cried out, her voice breaking on the words. She gave the hive a shake, and the agitated humming of the bees became a roar.
"Little ones, they would kill my child. When I set you free, avenge us!"
She raised the hive higher yet in her arms, preparatory to smashing it to the floor. The injured man at her feet groaned loudly.
"Hold!" cried the stout man. "I'll give you your child."
Molly froze. All could see that she could not hold the weight of the hive box much longer. There was strain in her voice, but she calmly directed,
"Give my baby to the man. Let them both come to me, for you shall all die most certainly and most horribly."
The stout man looked uncertainly at Redbeard. Candles in one hand and sword in the other. Redbeard had retreated from the table, but the bees still buzzed confusedly about him. His efforts to slap them away only seemed to make them more determined.
"King Regal will kill us, do we fail?"
"Then die from my bees instead," Molly suggested. "There are hundreds of bees in here," she added in a low voice. Her tone was almost seductive as she offered. "They will get inside your shirts and the legs of your trousers. They will cling to your hair as they sting. They will crawl into your ears and sting, and up your noses. And when you scream, they will crowd into your mouth dozens of humming, fuzzy bodies to sting your tongue until it will not fit inside your mouth. You will die choking on them."
Her description seemed to decide them. The stout man crossed the room to Burridge, thrust the still-screaming babe into his arms. Redbeard glared, but said nothing. Burridge took nettle, but did not neglect to stoop and seize up his sword as well. Molly glared at Redbeard.
"You! Get over there beside him, Burridge. Take nettle outside. Take her to where we picked mint yesterday. If they force me to act, I do not wish her to see it. It might make her fear the very bees who are her servants."
Burridge obeyed. Of all the things I had witnessed that night, that seemed to me the most amazing. Once he was outside, Molly backed slowly toward the door.
"Do not follow," she warned them. "My wit bees will be keeping watch for me. Right outside the door."
She gave the hive a final shake. The roaring hum increased, and several more bees escaped into the room, buzzing angrily. The stout man stood frozen, but Redbeard had lifted his sword as if it would defend him. The man on the floor gave an incoherent cry and scrabbled away from her as Molly backed outside. She dragged the door shut behind her, then leaned the hive against it. She took the lid off the hive, and then kicked it before she turned and ran off into the night.
"Burridge!" she called quietly. "I'm coming!"
She did not go toward the road, but off toward the woods. She did not look back.
"Come away, Fitz."
It was no Skilling, but Verity's soft voice close by me.
"You have seen them safe. Watch no more, lest others see with your eyes and know where they go. It is better if you do not know yourself. Come away."
I opened my eyes to the dimness inside the tent. Not only Verity, but Kettle sat beside me. Kettle's mouth was set in a flat line of disapproval. Verity's face was stern, but
Understanding was also there. He spoke before I could.
Did I believe you had sought that, I would be most angry with you. Now I say to you plainly, it is better if you know nothing of them, nothing at all. Had you heeded me when I first advised you of that, none of them would have been threatened as they were tonight.
You both were watching?
I asked quietly. For an instant, I was touched. They both cared that much for my child. She is my heir, too. Verity pointed out relentlessly. Do you think I could stand by and do nothing if they had injured her? He shook his head at me.
Stay away from them, Fitz, for all our sakes. Do you understand?
I nodded my head. His words could not distress me. I had already decided I would choose not to know where Molly and Burridge took Nettle, but not because she was Verity's heir. Kettle and Verity stood and left the tent. I flung myself back into my blankets. The fool, who had been propped on one elbow, lay down also.
I will tell you tomorrow,
I told him. He nodded mutely, his eyes huge in his pale face. Then he lay back down. I think he went to sleep. I stared up into darkness. Night Eyes came to lie beside me.
He would protect your cub as his own,
he pointed out quietly.
That is Pack.
He meant the words for comfort. I did not need them. Instead, I reached to rest a hand on his ruff.
Did you see how she stood and faced them down?
I demanded with pride.
A most excellent bitch,
Night Eyes agreed. I felt I had not slept at all when Starling woke the fool and I for our watch. I came out of the tent, stretching and yawning, and suspecting that keeping watch was not really a necessity. But the last shard of night was pleasantly mild, and Starling had left meat broth simmering at the fire's edge. I was halfway through a mug when the fool finally followed me out.
Starling showed me her harp last night,
I said by way of greeting. He smirked with satisfaction.
A crude bit of work. Ah, this was but one of his early efforts, they shall say of it some day.
He added with strained modesty. Kettle said you have no caution.
No, I have not, Fitz. What do we do here?
Me, what I'm told. When my watch is over, I'm off to the hills to gather broom twigs, so that I can sweep the rock chips out of Verity's way.
Ah, now there's lofty work for a catalyst. And what shall a prophet do you suppose?
You might prophesy when that dragon will be finished. I fear we shall think of nothing else until it is done. The fool was shaking his head minutely.
What?
I demanded.
I do not feel. We were called here to make brooms and harps. This feels like a lull to me, my friend, the lull before the storm.
Now there's a cheery thought, I told him glumly, but privately I wondered if he might not be right.
Are you going to tell me what went on last night?
When my account was finished, the fool sat, grinning.
A resourceful lass, that one,
he observed proudly. Then he cocked his head at me.
Think you the baby will be witted? Or be able to skill?
I had never stopped to consider it. I hope not, I said immediately, and then wondered at my own words. Dawn had scarcely broken before both Verity and Kettle arose. They each drank a mug of broth, standing, and carried off dried meat as they headed back up to the dragon. Ketrickin had also come out of Verity's tent. Her eyes were hollow, and defeat was in the set of her mouth. She had but half a mug of broth before setting it aside. She went back into the tent and returned with a basket fashioned into a carry sack.
Firewood,
she replied flatly, to my raised eyebrow. Then Night Eyes and I may as well go with you. I need to gather broom twigs and a stick.
And he needs to do something besides sleep and grow fat.
And you fear to go off in the woods without me?
If sows like that abound in these woods, you are absolutely correct. Perhaps Kettrickin would bring her bow? But even as I turned to make the suggestion, she was ducking back into the tent to fetch it.
In case we meet another pig,
she told me as she came out. But it was an uneventful expedition. Outside the quarry, the countryside was hilly and pleasant. We stopped at the stream to drink and wash. I saw the flash of a tiny fingerling in the water, and the wolf immediately wanted to fish. I told him I would, after I had finished gathering my broom. So he came at my heels, but reluctantly. I gathered my broom twigs and found a long, straight branch for a handle. Then we filled Kettrickin's carry sack with wood, which I insisted on bearing so her hands could be free for her bow. On the way back to camp, we stopped at the stream. I looked for a place where plants overhung the bank, and it did not take us long to find one. We then spent far longer than I had intended in tickling for fish. Kettrickin had never seen it done before, but after some impatience she caught the trick of it. They were a kind of trout I had not seen before, tinged with pink along their bellies. We caught 10, and I cleaned them there, with night ice snapping up the entrails as quickly as I gutted them. Kettrickin threaded them onto a willow stick, and we returned to camp. I had not realized how much the quiet interlude had soothed my spirits until we came in sight of the black pillar guarding the mouth of the quarry. It seemed more ominous than ever, like some dark, scolding finger lifted to warn me that, indeed, this might be the lull. But the storm was coming. I gave a small shudder as I passed it. My skill sensitivity seemed to be growing again. The pillar radiated controlled power, luringly. Almost against my will, I stopped to study the characters incised on it.
"Fitz, are you coming?"
Kettrickin called back to me, and only then did I realize how long I had been gawking. I hastened to catch up with them and rejoin them just as they were passing the girl on a dragon. I had deliberately avoided that spot since the fool had touched her. Now I glanced up guiltily to where the silver fingerprint still shone against her flawless skin.
"Who were you? And why did you make such a sad carving?"
I asked her. But her stone eyes only looked at me pleadingly above her tear-specked cheeks.
"Maybe she could not finish her dragon,"
Kettrickin speculated.
"See how its hind feet and tail are still trapped in the stone? Maybe that's why it's so sad. She must have carved it sad to begin with, don't you see? Whether or not she finished it, the upper portion would be the same."
Kettrickin looked at me in amusement.
"You still don't believe that Verity's dragon will fly when it is finished?"
"I do.
Of course, I have very little else to believe in anymore. Very little."
I had been going to tell her I thought it a minstrel's tale for a child, but her final words shut my mouth. Back at the dragon, I bound my broom together and went at my sweeping with a vengeance. The sun was high in a bright blue sky with a light and pleasant breeze. It was altogether a lovely day, and for a time I forgot all else in my simple chore. Kettrickin unloaded her firewood and soon left to get more. Night Eyes followed at her heels, and I noticed with approval that Starling and the Fool hastened after her with carry sacks of their own. With the rock chips and dust cleared away from the dragon, I could see more of the progress Verity and Kettle had made. The black stone of the dragon's back was so shiny it almost reflected the blue of the sky. I observed as much to Verity, not really expecting an answer. His mind and heart were focused entirely on the dragon. On all other topics his mind seemed vague and wandering, and when he spoke to me of his dragon and the fashioning of it, he was very much King Verity. A few moments later he rocked back on his heels from his crouch beside the dragon's foot. He stood and ran a silver hand tentatively over the dragon's back. I caught my breath, for in the wake of his hand there was suddenly color, a rich turquoise, with every scale edged in silver, followed the sweep of Verity's finger. The hue shimmered there for an instant, then faded. Verity made a small sound of satisfaction. When the dragon is full, the color will stay, he told me. Without thinking, I reached a hand toward the dragon, but Verity abruptly shouldered me aside. Don't touch him, he warned me, almost jealously. He must have seen the shock on my face, for he looked rueful.
It's not safe for you to touch him any more, Fitz. He is too...
His voice trailed off, and his eyes went afar in search of a word. Then he apparently forgot all about me, for he crouched back to his work on the creature's foot. There is nothing like being treated like a child to provoke one to act that way. I finished the last of my sweeping, set my broom aside, and wandered off. I was not overly surprised when I found myself staring up at the girl on a dragon again. I had come to think of the statue as girl on a dragon, for they did not seem like separate entities to me. Once more I climbed up on the dais beside her. Once more I felt the swirling of her witlife. It lifted like fog and reached toward me hungrily. So much entrapped misery.
There is nothing I can do for you,
I told her sadly, and almost felt that she responded to my words. It was too saddening to remain close to her for long, but as I clambered down, I noticed that which alarmed me. Around one of the dragon's hind feet, someone had been chiseling at the miring stone. I stooped down for a closer inspection. The chips and dust had been cleared from the cut, and the edges of it were new and sharp. The fool, I told myself, was truly without caution. I stood with the intention of seeking him out immediately.
Fitzchivalry, return to me at once, please.
I sighed to myself. Probably more stone chips to sweep. For this I must be away from Molly while she fended for herself. As I walked back to the dragon, I indulged myself in forbidden thoughts of her. I wondered if they had found a place to shelter, and how badly Burridge was hurt. They had fled with little more than the clothes on their backs. How would they survive? Or had Regal's men attacked them again? Had they dragged her and the baby off to Tradeford? Did Burridge lie dead in the dirt somewhere?
Do you truly believe that could happen and you not know of it? Besides, she seemed more than capable of caring for herself and the child, and Burridge, for that matter. Stop thinking of them, and stop indulging in self-pity. I have a task for you.
I returned to the dragon and picked up my broom. I had been sweeping for some minutes before Verity seemed to notice me.
Ah, Fitz, there you are.
He stood, stretched, arching his back to take the ache out of it.
Come with me.
I followed him down to the campfire where he busied himself for a moment by putting water to heat. He picked up a piece of dry cooked meat, looked at it, and said sadly,
What I would not give for one piece of Sarah's fresh bread.
Oh, well.
He turned to me. Sit down, Fitz. I want to talk to you. I've been giving much thought to all you told me, and I've an errand for you. I sat down slowly on a stone by the fire, shaking my head to myself. One moment he made no sense at all to me. The next he sounded just like the man who had been my mentor for so long. He gave me no time to mull my thoughts.
Fitz, you visited the place of the dragons on your way here. You told me that you and the wolf sensed life in them. Witlife, you called it. And that one, reeled as dragon, seemed almost to awaken when you called him by name.
I get the same sense of life from the girl on the dragon in the quarry. I agreed with him.
Verity shook his head. Poor thing. Nothing can be done for her, I fear. She persisted in trying to keep her human shape, and thus she held back from filling her dragon. There she is, and likely to remain for all time. I have taken to heart her warning. At least her error has done that much good. When I fill the dragon, I shall hold nothing back. It would be a poor ending, would it not? To have come so far and sacrificed so much to end only with a mired dragon? That mistake, at least, I shall not make.
He bit off a chunk of the dry meat and chewed it thoughtfully. I kept silent. He had lost me again. Sometimes all I could do was wait until his own thoughts brought him back to some topic where he made sense. I noticed he had a new smudge of silver on the top of his brow, as if he had unthinkingly wiped sweat away. He swallowed. "Are there any tea herbs left?" he asked, and then added, "I want you to return to the dragons. I want you to see if you can use your wit with your skill to awaken them. When I was there, try as I might, I could detect no life in any of them. I feared they had slumbered too long and starved themselves to death, feeding only on their own dreams until nothing was left." Starling had left a handful of wilted nettles and mint. I gingerly coaxed them into a pot, then spilled the heated water over them. While they steeped, I sorted my thoughts. "You want me to use the wit and skill to awake the dragon statues? How?" Verity shrugged. "I don't know. Despite all Kestrel has told me, there are still great gaps in my knowledge of the skill. When Galen stole Solicity's books and ceased all training for chivalry in me, it was a master stroke against us. I still keep coming back to that. Did he even then plot to secure the throne for his half-brother, or was he merely greedy for power? We will never know." I spoke then of a thing I had never before voiced. "There is something I do not understand. Kettle says that your killing Carrot with the skill left you injured yourself. Yet you drained Galen, and seemed to suffer nothing from it, nor did Serene and Justin seem to take ill from draining the king." "Draining off another's skill is not the same as killing one with a blast of skill." He gave a brief snort of bitter laughter. "Having done both, I well know the difference. In the end, Galen chose to die rather than surrender all his power to me. I suspect that my father made the same choice. I also suspect that he did so to keep from them the knowledge of where I was. What secrets Galen died protecting, we now have an inkling." He looked at the meat in his hand, set it aside. "But what concerns us now is waking the elderlings. You look about us and see a lovely day, Fitz. I see fair seas and a clean wind to bring red ships to our shores, while I chip and scrape and labor. 6 Duchy's folk die or are forged, not to mention that Regal's troops harry and burn the mountain villages along the border. My own queen's father rides to battle to protect his folk from my brother's armies. How that rankles me. Could you rouse the dragons to their defense? They could take flight now." "I am reluctant to undertake a task when I do not know just what it demands," I began, but Verity stopped me with a grin. "It seems to me that just yesterday that was what you were begging to do, Fitzchivalry." He had me. "Night Eyes and I will set out tomorrow morning," I offered. He frowned at me. "I see no reason to delay. It is no long journey for you, but merely a step through the pillar. But the wolf cannot pass through the stone. He will have to stay here. And I would that you went now. He told me so calmly to go without my wolf. I would sooner have gone stark naked. Now? As in immediately?" "Why not? You can be there in a matter of minutes. See what you can do. If you are successful, I shall know it. If not, come back to us tonight, through the pillar. We will have lost nothing by trying." "Do you think the coterie is no longer a danger?"
"They are no greater a danger to you there than here. Now go."
"Should I wait for the others to return and let them know where I have gone?"
"I will tell them myself, Fitzchivalry.
Will you do this thing for me?" There could be only one answer to such a question. "I will. I go now." I hesitated a final time. "I am not sure how to use the pillar."
"It is no more complicated than a door, Fitz. Place your hand on it, and it draws on the skill within you. Here. This symbol."
He sketched with a finger in the dust.
"That is the one for the place of the dragons. Simply put your hand on it and walk through. This," another sketch in the dust, "is the sign for the quarry. It will bring you back here."
He lifted his dark eyes to regard me steadily. Was there a test in those eyes? "I shall be back this evening," I promised him.
Good.
Luck ride with you, he told me. And that was it. I rose and left the fire behind me, walking toward the pillar. I passed girl on a dragon and tried not to be distracted by her. Somewhere off in the woods the others were gathering firewood, while Night Eyes ranged all around them.
Are you really going without me?
I shall not be gone long, my brother.
Shall I come back and wait for you by the pillar?
No. Watch over the queen for me, if you would.
With pleasure. She shot a bird for me today.
I sensed his admiration and sincerity. What finer thing than a bitch who kills efficiently?
A bitch who shares well.
See that you save some for me as well.
You can have the fish,
he assured me magnanimously. I looked up at the black pillar that now loomed before me. There was the symbol. As simple as a door, Verity had said. Touch the symbol and pass through.
Perhaps.
But my stomach was full of butterflies, and it was all I could do to lift my hand and press it to the shining black stone. My palm met the symbol, and I felt a cold tug of skill. I stepped through. I went from bright sunlight to cool, dappling shade. I stepped away from the tall black pillar and into deeply grassed earth. The air was heavy with moisture and plant smells. Branches that had been beaded with leaf buds the last time I had been here were now lush with foliage. A chorus of insects and frogs greeted me. The forest around me swarmed with life. After the empty silence of the quarry, it was almost overwhelming. I stood for a time just adjusting to it. Cautiously, I lowered my skill walls and reached warily out. Save for the pillar behind me, I had no sense of skill in use. I relaxed a bit. Perhaps Verity's blasting of Carrot had done more than he realized. Perhaps they feared to challenge him directly now. I warmed myself with that thought as I set off through the luxuriant growth. I was soon soaked to the knee. It was not that there was water underfoot, but that the riotous growth of grasses and reeds that I waded through were laden with moisture. Overhead, twining vines and hanging leaves dripped. I did not mind. It seemed refreshing after the bare stone and dust of the quarry. What had been a rudimentary pathway the last time we were here was now a narrow corridor through leaning, sprawling plant life. I came to a shallow, gurgling stream and took a handful of peppery cress from it to nibble as I walked. I promised I would take some back to camp with me come nightfall, and then recalled myself to my mission. Dragons. Where were the dragons? They had not moved, though greenery grew taller around them than it had been. I spotted a lightning-blasted stump, I remembered, and from there found Rielder's dragon. I had already decided he might be the most promising one to start with, for I had definitely felt a strong wit-life in him. As if it could make some difference, I took a few minutes to clear him of vines and wet, clinging grasses. As I did so, one thing struck me. The way the sleeping creature was sprawled upon the earth followed the contour of the ground beneath him. It did not look like a statue carved and then just set in place here. It looked like a living creature that had flung itself down to rest, and never moved again. I tried to force belief on myself. These were the very elderlings that rose to King Wisdom's call. They flew like great birds to the coast, and there they defeated the raiders and drove them from our shores. From the skies they fell on the ships, driving the crews mad with terror, or oversetting the ships with great wind from their wings. And they would again. Could we but wake them? I shall try, I said aloud, and then repeated, I shall wake them, and sought to have no doubt in my voice. I walked slowly about, Rielder's dragon, trying to decide how to begin. From the wedge-shaped reptilian head to the barbed tail, this was one stone dragon that was all of the stuff of legend. I reached an admiring hand to run it over the gleaming scales. I could sense the wit curling lazily through it like smoke. I willed myself to believe in the life in it. Could any artist have contrived so perfect a rendering? There were knobs of bone at the apex of its wings, similar to those on a gander. I did not doubt that it could clout a man down with it. The barbs of its tail were still sharp and nasty. I could imagine it lashing through rigging or rowers, shearing, slicing, snagging. "Reelder!" I cried aloud to it. "Reelder!" I felt no response. Not a stirring of skill, not even much difference in its wit. Well, I told myself, I had not expected it to be that easy. In the next few hours I tried every way I could imagine to wake that beast. I pressed my face to its scaly cheek, and quested into that stone as deeply as I could probe. I got less response from it than an earthworm would have given me. I stretched my body out beside that cold stone lizard, and willed myself to oneness with it. I sought to bond with that lazy stirring of wit within it. I radiated affection toward it. I commanded it strenuously. Ida, help me, I even sought to threaten it with dire consequences if it did not arise to obey my command. It all availed me nothing. I began to clutch at straws. I recalled the fool to it. Nothing. I reached back for the skill dream the fool and I had shared. I brought into my mind every detail of the woman in the rooster crown that I could recall. I offered her to the dragon. There was no response. I tried basic things. Verity said perhaps they had starved. I visualized pools of cool, sweet water. Fat, silvery fish there for the devouring. I skill-visualized Reelder's dragon being devoured by a greater one, and offered it that picture. No response. I ventured to reach for my king. If there is life in these stones, it is too small and sunken for me to reach. It troubled me a little that Verity did not even bother to reply. But perhaps he, too, had seen this as a desperation measure, with small chance of success. I left Reelder's dragon and wandered for a time from stone beast to stone beast. I quested amongst them, looked for any that might have a stronger flicker of wit life to them. Once I thought I had found one, but a closer check showed me that a field mouse had made its home under the dragon's chest. I chose a dragon antlered like a buck, and tried again every tactic I had tried on Reelder's dragon, with as little result. By then, the daylight was waning. As I picked my way through the streets back to the pillar, I wondered if Verity had truly expected any sort of success. Doggedly, I moved from dragon to dragon on my way back to the pillar, giving each one a last effort. It was probably what saved me. I straightened from one, thinking I felt a strong wit life coming from the next one. But when I got to him, the hulking winged boar with his curving razor tusks, I perceived the wit was coming from beyond him. I lifted my eyes and peered through the trees, rather expecting to see a deer or wild pig. Instead, I saw a man with a drawn sword standing with his back to me. I folded up behind the boar. My mouth was suddenly dry, my heart hammering. He was neither Verity nor the fool. That much I knew in an instant's glance. He was someone shorter than I, sandy-haired, and holding a sword as if he knew how to wield it. Someone dressed in gold and brown, not bulky Burl, nor slender Dark Will. Someone else, but Regals. In a moment, all became clear to me. How stupid could I have been? I had destroyed Will and Burl's men, horses and supplies. What else would they do but skill to Regal that they needed more? But the constant skirmishing along the mountain borders, it would be no trick for another riding party to slip through, bypass Jompe, and travel up the Skill Road. The slide area we had crossed was a formidable barrier, but not an insurmountable one. Risking his men's life was something Regal was proficient at. I wondered how many had attempted the crossing and how many had survived. I was sure now that Will and Burl were once more comfortably provisioned. Then a more chilling thought struck me. He might be skilled. There was nothing to stop Will from training others. He had all Solicitor's books and scrolls to draw on, and while skill potential was not common, it was not excessively rare. In moments my imagination had multiplied the man to an army, all at least marginally skilled, all fanatically loyal to Regal. I leaned against the stone bore, trying to breathe softly despite the fear coursing through me. For a moment, despair had me in thrall. I had finally realized the immensity of the resources that Regal could turn against us. This was no private vendetta between us. This was a king with a king's armies and powers, out to exterminate those he had branded as traitors. The only thing that had bound Regal's hand before was the possible embarrassment if it were discovered that Verity had not died. Now, back in this remote area, he had nothing to fear. He could use his soldiers to do away with his brother and nephew, his sister-in-law, with all witnesses. Then his coterie could dispose of the soldiers. Those thoughts passed through my mind the way lightning illuminates the blackest night. In one flash I suddenly saw all details. In the next moment, I knew I must get to the pillar and back to the quarry to warn Verity, if it were not already too late. I felt myself calm as soon as I had a goal in mind. I considered skilling to Verity and quickly rejected the idea. Until I knew my enemy better, I would not risk exposing myself to him. I found myself seeing it as if it were Kettle's game, stones to capture or destroy. The man was between me and the pillar. That was to be expected. What I now had to discover was if there were others as well. I drew my own belt knife. A sword was no weapon to use in dense brush. I took a deep, steadying breath and slipped away from the boar. I had a rough familiarity with the area. It served me in good stead as I moved from dragon to tree trunk to old stump. Before darkness was complete, I knew there were three men and that they seemed to be guarding the pillar. I did not think they had come here to hunt me, but rather to keep anyone save Regal's coterie from using the pillar. I had found the tracks of their passage from the Skill Road. They were fresh. The men newly arrived. I could then rely that I knew the lay of the land better than they did. I decided I would believe them unskilled, as they had come by the trail rather than by the pillar. But they were probably very able soldiers. I also decided I should believe Will and Burl might be very close by, able to come through the pillar at a moment's notice. For that reason I kept my skill walls high and tight. And I waited. When I did not return, Verity would know something was wrong. I did not think he would be so unwary as to come through the pillar in search of me. In truth, I did not think he would leave his dragon for that long. This was my own fix to get myself out of. As darkness fell, insects came out, stinging, biting, swarming insects by the hundreds, and always the one who insisted on humming right by my ear. Ground mists began to rise, damping my clothes to my body. The guards had made a small fire. I smelled hearth cakes cooking and found myself wondering if I could kill them before they had eaten them all. I grinned hard to myself and ghosted closer. Night and a fire and food usually meant talk. These men spoke little, and most of it was in low tones. They did not care for this duty. The long black road had driven some men mad, but tonight it was not the long way they had come, but the stone dragons themselves that bothered them. I also heard enough to confirm what I had guessed. There were three men guarding this pillar. There were a full dozen guarding the one at the plaza where the fool had had his vision. The main body of soldiers had pushed on toward the quarry. The coterie was seeking to close off escape routes for Verity. I felt a bit of relief that it would take them fully as long to get there as it had taken our party. For tonight, at least, Verity and the others were in no danger of attack. But it was only a matter of time. My resolution to get back through the pillar as swiftly as possible hardened. I had no intention of fighting them. That left killing them by ambush, one by one. A feat I doubted even Chade could have accomplished, or creating enough of a diversion to draw them off long enough for me to make a dash for the pillar. I slipped well away from these men to where I judged I was out of earshot, and proceeded to gather dry firewood. It was not an easy task in such a lush and verdant place, but I finally had a respectable armful. My plan was simple. I told myself it would either work or it wouldn't. I doubted I would get a second chance. They would be too cautious for that. I considered where the symbol for the quarry was on the pillar and worked my way around to the dragons that were on the opposite side of it. Of the dragons, I chose the fierce-looking fellow with ear tufts that I had remarked on my first visit here. He would cast a fine shadow. I cleared a space behind him of wet grass and leaves, and set my fire there. I had only enough fuel for a small fire, but I hoped I would not need more than that. I wanted enough light and smoke to be mysterious without enlightening. I got the fire going well, then slipped away from it in the darkness, belly in the grass. I worked my way as close to the pillar as I dared. Now I only need wait until the guards notice my fire. I hoped at least one man would go to investigate it, and that the other two would watch where he had gone. Then a noiseless dash, a slap to the pillar, and I'd be gone. Save that the guards did not notice my fire. From my vantage it seemed glaringly obvious. There was rising smoke and a rosy glow through the trees, partially outlining the dragon's silhouette. I had hoped that would pique their interest. Instead, it was blocking my fire too well. I decided a few well-placed rocks would draw their attention to my fire. My groping hands found only lush plant life growing in thick loam. After an interminable wait, I realized my fire was going out, and the guards had noticed it not at all. Once more I slipped out of earshot. Once more I gathered dry sticks in the dark. Then my nose, as much as my eyes, guided me back to my smoldering fire. "My brother, you are gone long. Is all well?" There was anxiety in Night-Eye's faint thought. "I am hunted. Be still. I shall come as soon as I can." I pushed the wolf gently from my thoughts and stole through the dark toward my dwindling fire. I refueled it and waited for it to catch. I was just slipping away from it when I heard their voices raised in speculation. I do not think I was careless. It was but an ill twist of luck that as I moved from the cover of a dragon to that of a tree, one guard lifted his torch high, throwing my shadow into stark relief.
"There, a man!"
one shouted, and two of them charged out at me. I eeled away through the wet underbrush. I heard one trip and fall, cursing, in a patch of vines, but the second was a swift and agile fellow. He was on my heels in an instant, and I swear I felt the wind from the first sweep of his sword. I lunged away from it, and found myself half leaping, half falling, over the stone boar. I clipped a knee painfully on the rocky back, and fell to the earth on the other side of him. Instantly I scrabbled to my feet. My pursuer leaped forward, swinging a mighty blow that surely would have cloven me in two if he had not caught his leg on one curving razor tusk. He tripped and fell squarely, impaling himself on the second tusk, where it thrust up like a scimitar from the boar's red maw. The sound the man made was not a large one. I saw him begin to struggle to rise, but the curve of the tusk was hooked inside him. I leaped to my feet, mindful of the second man who had been pursuing me, and fled into the dark. Behind me rose a long cry of pain. I kept my wits enough to circle. I had nearly reached the pillar when I felt a questing twist of skill. I recalled the last time I had felt such a thing. Was Verity himself under attack back at the quarry? One man still guarded the pillar. but I decided to risk his sword to get back to my king. I emerged from the trees, racing toward the pillar, while the guards stared off toward my fire and the cries of the fallen man. Another tendril of skill brushed me.
No! I cried out. Don't risk yourself!
As my king came through the pillar, notched grey sword clutched in his gleaming silver grip. He emerged behind the guard who had remained on post. My foolish cry had turned him toward the pillar, and he came at my king, sword lifted, even as his face betrayed his terror. Verity, in their firelight, looked like a demon out of a tale. His face was splashed with silver from the careless touching of his hands, while his hands and arms gleamed as if made of polished silver. His gaunt face and rugged clothes, the utter blackness of his eyes, would have terrified any man. I will have to give Regal's guard this. He stood his post and caught the king's first blow and turned it. Or so he thought. It was an old trick of Verity's. Instead, his blade wrapped the other. His cut should have severed the hand from the arm, but the dulled blade stopped at the bone. Nonetheless, the man dropped his sword. As the man fell to his knees, clutching at the gouting wound, Verity's sword swept in again, across his throat. I felt a second tremoring of skill. The lone remaining guard came racing toward us from the trees, his eyes fixed on Verity, and he cried out in terror. He halted where he stood. Verity took a step toward him.
"My king, enough! Let us leave!"
I cried out. I did not want him to risk himself for me again. Instead, Verity glanced down at his sword. He frowned. Suddenly he grasped the blade in his left hand, just below the hilt, and drew it through his shining grip. I gasped at what I saw. The sword he brandished now gleamed and came to a perfect point. Even by torchlight, I could see the wavering ripples of the many-folded metal of the blade. The king glanced at me. I should have known I could do that. He almost smiled. Then, Verity lifted it to the other man's eyes.
"When you are ready,"
he said quietly. What happened next stunned me. The soldier fell to his knees, casting his sword into the grass before him.
"My king, I know you, even if you do not know me."
Buck accent spoke plainly in his tumbling words.
"My lord, we were told that you were dead, dead because your queen and the bastard had conspired against you. Those were who we were told might be found here. It was half for the revenge that I came. I served you well at Buck, my lord, and if you live, I serve my king still."
Verity peered at him in the flickering torchlight.
"You're Tig, aren't you? Reaver's boy."
The soldier's eyes widened that Verity recalled him.
"Tag, my lord, serving my king, as my father did before me."
His voice shook a bit. His dark eyes never left the point of the sword Verity had leveled at him. Verity lowered his blade.
"Do you speak the truth, lad, or simply seek to save your skin?"
The young soldier looked up at Verity and dared to smile.
"I have no need to fear. The prince I served would not strike down a kneeling, unarmed man. I dare say the king will not either."
Perhaps no other words would have convinced Verity. Despite his weariness, he smiled.
"Go then, Tag. Go as swift as you may and as silent as you may, for those who have used you will kill you if they know you are true to me. Return to Buck, and on the way there, and when you get there, tell everyone that I shall be returning, that I shall bring my good and true queen with me to sit the throne, and that my heir will claim it after me. And when you get to Buckkeep Castle, present yourself to my brother's wife. Tell the Lady Patience that I commend you to her service."
"Yes, my king, King Verity."
"What is it?"
"More troops are coming. We are but the vanguard."
He paused. He swallowed.
I accuse no one of treachery, least of all your own brother, but...
Let it not concern you, Tag. What I have asked you to do is important to me. Go quickly and challenge no one on your way, but carry back those tidings as I have asked you.
Yes, my king.
Now, Verity suggested. And Tag rose, took up his sword and sheathed it, and strode off into the darkness. Verity turned, and his eyes shone with triumph.
We can do it,
he told me quietly. He gestured me fiercely toward the pillar. I reached to palm the symbol and tumbled through as the skill clutched at me. Verity came on my heels. 37. Feeding the Dragon. By midsummer of that final year, the Six Duchies' situation had become desperate. Buckkeep Castle, so long avoided by the raiders, came under sudden siege from them. They had possessed Antler Island and its watchtowers since midwinter. Forge, the first village to fall victim to the scourge that took its name, had long since become a watering stop for red ships. There had been for some time rumors of out-island sailing ships anchoring off Scrim Island, including several sightings of the elusive White Ship. For most of the spring, no ships had made passage either into or out of Buck Harbor. This strangle of trade was felt not just in Buck, but in every trade village on the Buck, Bear, and Vin rivers. The red ships had become a sudden reality to the merchants and lords of Tilth and Farrow. But at the high point of summer, the red ships came to Buckkeep Town. The red ships came in the dead of night after several weeks of deceptive quiet. The fighting was the savage defense of a cornered folk, but they were also a starved and beggared folk. Almost every wooden structure of the town was burned to the ground. It is estimated that only one quarter of the town's residents were able to flee up the steep hills to Buckkeep Castle. Although Lord Bright had endeavored to refortify and supply the castle, the weeks of strangulation had taken their toll. The deep wells of Buckkeep Castle assured them a good supply of fresh water, but all other things were in scarce supply. Catapults and other engines of war had been in place for decades to defend the mouth of the Buck River. But Lord Bright diverted them to the defense of Buckkeep Castle itself. Unchallenged, the red ships beat their way up the Buck River, carrying their war and forging deep into the Six Duchies like a spreading poison, following a vein to the heart. At a time when red ships threatened Tradeford itself, the lords of Farrow and Tilth were to discover that a great part of the Six Duchies' army had been sent far inland, to Blue Lake and beyond, to the very borders of the Mountain Kingdom. The nobles of these duchies suddenly discovered that their own guardsmen were all that stood between them and death and ruin. I emerged from the pillar into a circle of frantic people. The first thing to happen was that a wolf hit me full force in the chest, driving me backward, so that as Verity emerged he all but fell over me.
I made her understand me. I made her know you were in danger, and she made him go after you. I made her understand me. I made her understand me.
Night Eyes was in a puppyish frenzy. He thrust his nose into my face, nipped at my nose, then flung himself to the ground beside me, and half in my lap.
He stirred a dragon, not quite awakening, but I fell one stir. We may yet wake them all.
This was Verity, laughing and shouting to the others these good tidings, as he calmly stepped over us. He flourished his shining sword, as if to challenge the moon. I had no idea what he was talking about. I sat flat on the earth, staring around at them. The fool looked wan and weary. Ketrickin, ever a mirror to her king, smiled at his exultation. Starling looked at all of us with greedy minstrel eyes, memorizing every detail. And Kettle, her hands and arms silver to the elbow, knelt carefully beside me to ask,
"Are you all right, Fitzchivalry?"
I looked at her magic-coated arms and hands. "What have you done?" I asked her.
"Only what was necessary. Verity took me to the river in the city. Now our work will proceed more swiftly. What happened to you?"
I did not answer her. Instead, I pinned Verity with a glare.
"You sent me off so I would not follow you. You knew I could not wake the dragons, but you wanted me out of the way."
I could not conceal the outrage and betrayal I felt. Verity gave me one of his old grins, denying all regrets.
"We know one another very well, don't we?"
was all he offered by way of apology. Then his grin grew wider.
"Yes, it was a fool's errand I sent you on, but I was the fool, for you did it. You woke one. Or stirred him, at least."
I shook my head at him.
"Yes, you did. You must have felt it, that rippling of skill just before I reached you. What did you do? How did you stir him?"
"A man died on the stone boar's tusks," I said flatly. "Perhaps that is how you rouse these dragons, with death." I cannot explain the hurt I felt. He had taken what should have been mine and given it to Kettle. He owed that skill closeness to me, no other. Who else had come so far, given up so much for him? How could he deny me the carving of his dragon? It was skill hunger, pure and simple. But I did not know it then. At that time all I could feel was how perfectly linked he was with Kettle, and how firmly he repulsed me from joining that link. He walled me out as firmly as if I were regal. I had forsaken my wife and child and crossed all of the 6 duchies to be of service to him, and now he turned me away. He should have taken me to the river, been beside me as I had that experience. I had never known myself capable of such jealousy. Night Eyes came back from frisking about Ketrickan to push his head under my arm. I rubbed his throat and hugged him. He at least was mine.
"She understood me," he repeated anxiously. "I made her understand, and she told him he must go."
Ketrickan, coming to stand beside me, said,
"I had the strongest feeling you needed help. It took much urging, but finally, Verity left the dragon and went for you. Are you much hurt?"
I got to my feet slowly, dusting myself off.
"Only my pride, that my king would treat me as a child. He might have let me know he preferred Kettle's company."
A flash of something in Ketrickan's eyes made me recall to whom I spoke. But she hid her twin hurt well, saying only,
"A man was killed, you say?"
"Not by me. He fell on the stone boar's tusks in the dark and gutted himself. But I saw no stirring of dragons."
"Not the death, but the spilled life," Kettle said to Verity. "That might be it. Like the scent of fresh meat, rousing a dog starved near to death. They are hungry, my king, but not past rousing. Not if you find a way to feed them."
"I like not the sound of that," I exclaimed.
"It is not for us to like or dislike," Verity said heavily. "It is the nature of dragons. They must be filled, and life is what fills them. It must be given willingly to create one. But dragons will take what they need to sustain them once they rise in flight. What had you supposed that King Wisdom offered them in return for defeating the red ships?"
Kettle pointed a scolding finger at the fool. "Pay heed to that fool, and understand now why you are so weary. When you touched her with skill, you linked with her. She draws you to her now, and you think you go out of pity, but she will take from you whatever she needs to rise, even if it is your whole life."
"No one is making any sense,"
I declared. Then, as my own scattered wits returned to me, I exclaimed,
"Regal has soldiers. They are on the march here. They are no more than a few days away at most. I suspect they push themselves and travel swiftly. The men guarding the pillars are placed there to prevent Verity's escape."
It was much later that night before I had it all sorted out. Kettle and Verity had indeed gone to the river almost as soon as I left. They had used the pillar to get down to the city, and there they had laved Kettle's arms in the stuff and renewed the power in Verity's. Every glimpse of that silvering of her arms woke in me a skill hunger that was almost a lust. It was something I masked from myself and attempted to hide from Verity. I do not believe he was deceived, but he did not force me to confront it. I masked my jealousy with other excuses. I told them both, hotly, it was only the purest luck that they had not encountered the coterie there. Verity had calmly replied that he had known the risk and taken it. Somehow it hurt me all the more that even my anger left him so unmoved. It had been on their return that they had discovered the fool chipping at the stone that mired Girl on a Dragon. He had cleared an area around one foot and began on another. The foot itself remained a shapeless chunk of stone, but the fool insisted that he could feel the foot intact inside the stone. He felt certain that all she wished from him was that he chop the dragon free of that which mired it. He had been shaking with exhaustion when they found him. Kettle had insisted he go right to bed. She had taken the last piece of often-boiled elf bark and ground it down fine to make one last dose of tea for him. Despite the drug, he remained detached and weary, scarcely even asking a question as to what had happened to me. I felt deep uneasiness for him. The news I had brought of Regal's men stirred everyone to action. After food, Verity sent Starling, the Fool, and the Wolf to the mouth of the quarry to keep watch there. I sat by the fire for a time with a cold wet rag wrapped around my swollen and discolored knee. Up on the dragon dais, Kedrickin kept her fires burning, and Verity and Kettle worked the stone. Starling, in helping Kettle search for more elf bark, had discovered the charis seeds that Chade had given me. Kettle had appropriated them and brewed them up into a stimulant drink she and Verity were sharing. The noise of their work had taken on a frightening tempo. They had also found the sunskirt seeds I had bought so long ago as a possible substitute for elf bark. With a sly grin, Starling asked me why I was carrying those. When I explained, she had snorted with laughter and finally managed to explain they were regarded as an aphrodisiac. I recalled the herb seller's words to me and shook my head to myself. A part of me saw the humor, but I could not find a smile. After a time of sitting alone by the cook fire, I quested toward Night Eyes. "How goes it?" A sigh. "The minstrel would rather be playing with her harp. The scentless one would rather be chipping at that statue, and I would rather be hunting. If there is danger coming, it is a long way away. Let us hope it stays there."
"Keep watch, my friend."
I left the camp and gimped up the scree of stone to the dragon dais. Three of its feet were free now, and Verity worked on the final front foot. I stood for a time beside him, but he did not deign to notice me. Instead, he went on chipping and scraping, and all the while muttered old nursery rhymes or drinking songs to himself. I limped past Kettrickin, listlessly tending her fires, back to where Kettle was smoothing her hands over the dragon's tail. Her eyes were distant as she called for the scales, and then deepened their detail and added texture to them. Part of the tail also remained hidden in the stone. I started to lean on the thick portion of the tail to take weight off my bruised knee, but she immediately sat up and hissed at me, "Don't do that! Don't touch him!" I straightened away from him. "I touched him before," I said indignantly, "and it did no harm."
"That was before. He is much closer to completion now."
She lifted her eyes to mine. Even in the firelight I could mark how thickly rock dust coated her features and clung to her eyelashes. She looked dreadfully tired, and yet animated by some fierce energy.
"As close as you are to Verity, the dragon would reach for you, and you are not strong enough to say no. He would pull you in completely. That's how strong he is, how magnificently strong!"
She all but crooned the last words as she stroked her hands again down the tail. For an instant, I saw a sheen of color right behind their passage.
Is anyone ever going to explain any of this to me? I asked petulantly. She gave me a bemused look.
I try. Verity tries. But you of all people should know how wearisome words are. We try and try and try to tell you, and still your mind does not grasp it. It is not your fault. Words are not big enough, and it is too dangerous to include you in our skilling now.
Will you be able to make me understand after the dragon is finished? She looked at me, and something like pity crossed her face.
Fit chivalry, my dear friend, when the dragon is finished? Rather say that when Verity and I are finished, the dragon will be begun.
I don't understand. I snarled in frustration.
But he told you. I said it again when I warned the fool. Dragons feed on life, a whole life, willingly given. That is what it takes to make a dragon rise. And usually not just one. In olden times, when wise men sought out Jumpetown, they came as a coterie, as a whole that was more than the sum of its parts, and gave that all over into a dragon. The dragon must be filled. Verity and I must put all of ourselves, every part of our lives, into it. It is easier for me. Ida knows I have lived more than my share of years, and I have no desire to go on in this body. It is harder, much harder for Verity. He leaves behind his throne, his pretty loving wife, his love of doing things with his hands. He leaves behind riding a fine horse, hunting stags, walking amongst his own people. Oh, I feel them all within the dragon already, the careful inking of colour onto a map, the feel of a clean piece of vellum under his hands. I even know the smells of his inks now. He has put them all into the dragon. It is hard for him, but he does it, and the pain it costs him is one more thing he puts into the dragon. It will fuel his fury toward the red ships when he rises. In fact, there is only one thing he has held back from his dragon, only one thing that may make him fall short of his goal.
What is that? I asked her unwillingly. Her old eyes met mine.
You. He has refused to allow you to be put into the dragon. He could do it, you know, whether you willed it or not. He could simply reach out and pull you into him, but he refuses. He says you love your life too much. He will not take it from you. That you have already laid down too much of it for a king who has returned you only pain and hardship.
Did she know that with her words she gave Verity back to me? I suspect she did. I had seen much of her past during our skill-sharing. I knew the experience had to have flowed both ways. She knew how I had loved him, and how hurt I had been to find him so distant when I got here. I stood up immediately to go speak with him.
"Fitz,"
she called me back. I turned to her.
"Two things I would have you know, painful as you may find them."
I braced myself.
"Your mother loved you,"
she said quietly.
"You say you cannot recall her. Actually, you cannot forgive her, but she is there, with you, in your memories. She was tall and fair, a mountain woman, and she loved you. It was not her choice to part from you."
Her words angered me and dizzied me. I pushed away the knowledge she offered me. I knew I had no memories of the woman who had borne me. Time and again I had searched myself and found no trace of her, none at all. "And the second thing?" I asked her coldly. She did not react to my anger, save with pity.
"It is as bad, or perhaps worse. Again, it is a thing you already know. It is sad that the only gifts I can offer you, the catalyst who has changed my living death to dying life, are things you already possess. But there it is, and so I will say it. You will live to love again. You know you have lost your springtime girl, your Molly, on the beach with the wind in her brown hair and red cloak. You have been gone too long from her, and too much has befallen you both. And what you loved, what both of you truly loved, was not each other. It was the time of your life. It was the spring of your years, and life running strong in you, and war on your doorstep, and your strong, perfect bodies. Look back in truth. You will find you recall fully as many quarrels and tears as you do love-making and kisses, fits. Be wise. Let her go, and keep those memories intact. Save what you can of her, and let her keep what she can of the wild and daring boy she loved. Because both he and that merry little miss are no more than memories any more.
She shook her head.
No more than memories.
You are wrong!
I shouted furiously.
You are wrong!
The force of my cries had brought Ketrickin to her feet. She stared at me in fear and worry. I could not look at her. Tall and fair, my mother had been tall and fair. No, I recalled nothing of her. I strode past her, heedless of the wrench of pain my knee gave me at every step. I walked around the dragon, damning it with every step I took, and defying it to sense what I felt. When I reached Verity, working on the left forefoot, I crouched down beside him and spoke in a savage whisper. "Kettle says you are going to die when this dragon is done, that you will put all of yourself into it, or so with my feeble understanding of her words I take it. Tell me I am wrong." He leaned back on his heels and swiped at the chips he had loosened.
"You are wrong," he said mildly. "Fetch your broom, would you, and clear this?"
I fetched my broom and came up beside him, almost of a mind to break it over his head more than use it. I knew he sensed my simmering fury, but he still gestured for me to clear his workspace. I did so with one furious brush.
"Now," he said gently, "that is a fine anger you have, potent and strong. That, I think, I shall take for him."
Soft as the brush of a butterfly's wing, I felt the kiss of his skill. My anger was snatched from me, flayed whole from my soul, and swept away to...
No, don't follow it.
A gentle skill push from Verity, and I snapped back to my body. An instant later I found myself sitting flat on the stone, while the whole universe swung dizzyingly around my head. I curled forward, bringing up my knees to lean my head against. I felt wretchedly ill. My anger was gone, replaced by a weary numbness.
"There," Verity continued. "As you asked for, I have done. I think you understand better now what it is to put something into the dragon. Would you care to feed it more of yourself?" I shook my head mutely. I feared to open my mouth. "I will not die when the dragon is finished, Fitz. I will be consumed, that is true, quite literally. But I will go on. As the dragon, I found my voice. And Kettle?
Kestrel will be part of me, and her sister Gull. But I shall be the dragon." He had gone back to his wretched stone chipping.
"How can you do that?"
My voice was filled with accusation.
"How can you do that to Ketrickin? She's given up everything to come here to you, and you will simply leave her alone and childless?"
He leaned forward so that his forehead rested against the dragon. His endless chipping stopped. After a time, he spoke in a thick voice.
"I should have you stand here and talk to me while I work, Fitz. Just when I think I am past any great feelings at all, you stir them in me."
He lifted his face to regard me. His tears had cut two paths through the grey rock dust.
"What choice do I have?"
"Simply leave the dragon.
Let us go back to the six duchies and rally the folk, and fight the red ships with sword and skill, as we did before. Perhaps...
Perhaps we would all be dead before we even reached Jampe. Is that a better end for my queen? No. I shall carry her back to Buckkeep and clean the coasts, and she shall reign long and well as queen there. That is what I choose to give her. And an heir? I asked bitterly.
He shrugged wearily and took up his chisel again.
You know what must be. Your daughter will be raised as heir.
No! Threaten me with that again, and regardless of the risk, I will skill to Burich to flee with her.
You cannot skill to Burich,
Verity observed mildly. He appeared to be measuring for the dragon's toe.
Chivalry closed his mind to the skill years ago, to keep him from being used against chivalry. As the fool was used against you.
Another small mystery laid to rest. For all the good it did me.
Verity, please, I beg you, do not do this thing to me.
Far better I should be consumed in the dragon as well. I offer you that. Take my life and feed it to the dragon. I will give you anything you ask of me, but promise me that my daughter will not be sacrificed to the Farseer throne.
I cannot make you that promise, he said heavily.
If you bore any feelings at all for me any more, I began, but he interrupted me.
Cannot you understand?
No matter how often you are told.
I have feelings, but I have put them into the dragon.
I managed to stand up. I limped away. There was nothing more to say to him, king or man, uncle or friend. I seemed to have lost all knowledge of who he was. When I skilled toward him, I found only his walls. When I quested toward him with the wit, I found his life flickering between himself and the stone dragon, and of late, it seemed to burn brighter within the dragon, not Verity. There was no one else in camp, and the fire was nearly out. I flung more wood on it, and then sat eating dried meat beside it. The pig was nearly gone. We'd have to hunt again soon, or rather, Night Eyes and Ketrickin should hunt again. She seemed to bring meat down easily for him. My self-pity was losing its savour, but I could think of no better solution than to wish I had some brandy to drown it in. At last, with few other interesting alternatives, I went to bed. I slept, after a fashion. Dragons plagued my dreams, and Kettle's game took on odd meanings, as I tried to decide if a red stone was powerful enough to capture Molly. My dreams were rambling and incoherent, and I broke often to the surface of my sleep to stare at the dark inside the tent. I quested out once to where Night Eyes prowled near a small fire where Starling and the Fool slept turn and turn about. They had moved their sentry post to the brow of a hill, where they could command a good view of the winding Skill Road below them. I should have walked out and joined them. Instead, I rolled over and dipped into my dreams again. I dreamed of Regal's troops coming, not by dozens or scores, but by hundreds of golden-brown troops pouring into the quarry to corner us against the vertical black walls and kill us all. I awoke in the morning to the cold poke of a wolf's nose.
You need to hunt,
he told me seriously, and I agreed with him. As I emerged from my tent, I saw Ketrickin just coming down from the dais. Dawn was breaking. Her fires were needed no longer. She could sleep. But by the dragon, the endless clinking and scraping went on. Our eyes met as I stood up. She glanced at Night Eyes.
Going hunting?
She asked us both. The wolf gave a slow wag to his tail.
I'll fetch my bow, she announced,
and vanished into her tent. We waited. She came out wearing a cleaner jerkin and carrying her bow. I refused to look at Girl on a Dragon as we passed her. As we passed the pillar, I observed,
had we the folk to do it? We should put two on guard here, and two overlooking the road. Kettricken nodded to that. It is odd. I know they are coming to kill us, and I see small way for us to escape that fate. Yet we still go out to hunt for meat, as if eating were the most important thing. It is. Eating is living. Still, to live one must eat.
Kettricken echoed Nighteye's thought. We saw no game truly worthy of her bow. The wolf ran down a rabbit, and she brought down one brightly colored fowl. We ended up tickling for trout, and by midday had more than enough fish to feed us. At least for that day. I cleaned them on the bank of the stream, and then asked Kettricken if she would mind if I stayed to wash myself.
In truth, it might be a kindness to us all,
she replied.
And I smiled, not at her teasing, but that she was still able to do so.
In a short time I heard her splashing upstream from me, while Nighteyes dozed on the creek bank, his belly full of fish guts. As we passed Girl on a Dragon on the way back to camp, we found the fool curled up on the dais beside her, sound asleep. Kettricken woke him and scolded him for the fresh chisel marks about the dragon's tail. He professed no regrets, but only stated that Starling had said she would keep watch until evening, and he would really prefer to sleep here. We insisted he return to camp with us. We were talking amongst ourselves as we returned to the tent. Kettricken it was who stopped us suddenly.
Hush!
She cried out.
And then, listen!
We froze where we were. I half expected to hear Starling crying a warning to us. I strained my ears but heard nothing save the wind in the quarry and distant bird sounds. It took a moment for me to grasp the importance of that.
Verity!
I exclaimed. I shoved our fish into the fool's hands and began to run. Kettricken passed me. I had feared to find them both dead, attacked by Regal's coterie in our absence. What I found was almost as strange. Verity and Kettle stood, side by side, staring at their dragon. He shone black and glistening, as good flint in the afternoon sunlight. The great beast was complete. Every scale, every wrinkle, every claw was impeccable in its detail.
He surpasses every dragon we saw in the stone garden, I declared.
I had walked about him twice, and with every step I took, the wonder of him increased. Witlife burned powerfully in him now, stronger than it did in either Verity or Kettle. It was almost shocking that his sides did not bellow with breath, that he did not twitch in his sleep. I glanced to Verity, and despite the anger I still harbored,
I had to smile. He is perfect,
I said quietly.
I have failed,
he said without hope. Beside him, Kettle nodded miserably. The lines in her face had gone deeper. She looked every bit of 200 years old. So did Verity.
But he is finished, my lord, Kettricken said quietly. Is not this what you said you must do? Finish the dragon?
Verity shook his head slowly.